This is the Bird Hugger Podcast with Katherine Greenleaf, the podcast for people who love birds.
Welcome to the Bird Hugger Podcast. I'm Katherine Greenleaf, and I'm so glad to be with you. I'm on board for a full 30 minutes of talking all things birds and restoring native habitat.
What happens when a burnt-out college professor living in New England decides to become a wildlife rescuer and rehabilitator? Find out on Bird Hugger, the podcast for people who love birds. Join host Katherine Greenleaf, who has been rehabilitating injured wildlife for 20 years, and hear how you can turn your backyard into a native oasis for birds.
Hello there, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Bird Hugger Podcast. It's springtime, and everyone is eager to get into their gardens. With that thought in mind, I've asked award-winning science journalist Judith Schwartz back onto the show. The Vermont native is the author of the incredible book, Water in Plain Sight, Hope for a Thirsty World. In her book, she explains how most Americans are water illiterate. That is, they have no idea how your typical town and city infrastructures like sewers, parking lots, and paved roads contribute to the formation of out-of-control storm and drought cycles. At a time when groundwater and drinking water wells are shrinking throughout New England, she explains how each and every one of us can help our region regain a balance to our water stores by reducing impervious surfaces and trapping, slowing down, and holding rainwater in our gardens and yards. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. If you are enjoying this show and like what we do, please help us out by subscribing or following us on your favorite app to access our free show. That way you'll get notified of what's coming, you'll never miss a show, and it will help us in the ratings. Judith, welcome back to the show. It is great to have you here again.
Well, my pleasure.
This time around, I was hoping to talk to you about your wonderful book, Water in Plain Sight, Hope for a Thirsty World. Could you just talk to our audience for a minute? Tell them what brought this about. Why did you decide to write this book?
Yeah, so basically two reasons. So I had just written a book about soil, Cows Save the Planet, and Other Improbable Ways of Restoring Soil to Heal the Earth. And a couple of things struck me. One is the way that we talk about water is that water is a thing, that it either comes down from the sky or it doesn't. And what I came to understand is that we really can't talk about water, meaning our water challenges, water availability, too much water, as in floods that we're seeing all over the place, without also talking about land. Because if you have a drought and you get a lot of rain, but the soil is depleted and it's desertified, or maybe it's paved, much of the land is paved over, and the water doesn't soak into the land, well, then you'll be back in drought mode very quickly. The rainfall was not effective. So in my book, I really made a point of talking about water, not necessarily as a noun, but as a verb. Looking at how water works, how water moves across our landscapes and through the atmosphere, and how understanding how water works will help us address our many challenges. So related to that was water and climate. So whenever people made the connection between water and climate, it always went in one direction, which was how climate change will affect water. Warmer air holds more water, and then we'll get more bigger storms or melting snowpacks and et cetera. But what wasn't discussed is starting to be a little bit more now was how water affects climate, because our climate is largely regulated by water, by the phase changes of water. That is how the earth manages heat. So I thought it really important to talk about it, write about it. And I also thought it would be really helpful, because if we think about climate change as strictly about CO2 concentrations, well, what can we do besides cross our fingers and hope that the grown-ups will decide to reduce CO2 concentrations, okay? I mean, we can do little things, but as individuals, you know, we're kind of stalled. But if you bring water into the picture and we see all the ways, the natural processes that lead to natural cooling, and understand that we can start locally and create cooling right where we are, depending on where you are and what your needs are. But yeah, and then you can create microclimates, and then you can have an impact on regional climates by working with the water cycle.
Yeah, it is so amazing. Once you hook into your book and start reading up about small water cycles and what you can do locally in your own front yard and backyard, you start to realize that just a single person, a single yard can have an impact on the local rain systems for the better.
Oh, absolutely. And what's really important to understand is that anytime you have a dwelling, anything you've paved over, any impervious surface, you have altered the water cycle. So you can understand that and appreciate that by definition, living in a house, you are in water debt. And so you can make up for that debt by enhancing the water cycle on your land, whether that's putting swales or small earthworks, a rain garden, a rain barrel. And again, depending on where you live, you would have different strategies. And yeah, I just visited friends in California who have huge water tanks. They're in Northern California. And so while it was very rainy while I was visiting, they made it clear that they have 9 months without rain. So by collecting the rain during the wet season, then they can be self-sustaining water-wise through the year.
Right. It's funny, you know, we have a 1-acre property in New Hampshire. We have multiple rain barrels coming off our roof. We have rain gardens. We've switched out the front lawn to a native garden, which actually absorbs water instead of running it off out into the street and down the sewer. And I've already had several neighbors say to me, it seems like it rains more on your property than mine. What's up with that?
There you go.
And I try to explain to them, I'm creating small rainstorms by trapping and absorbing the water, increasing transpiration from the ground, from the soil. And they just kind of shake their heads in disbelief. But I do think people are starting to come around and realize that the more water you can trap on your property and keep absorbed in the soil, the better chance we have of returning to small water systems and local rains instead of these huge, humongous, destructive storms that are really having a big impact on the environment.
Indeed. Yes, they are. Yeah, it's pretty daunting. Here in Vermont, we've had lots and lots of storms. Last summer was pretty brutal.
Right. So could you talk about, you introduced in your book, Michael Kravchuk. I hope I'm pronouncing his name.
Michael Kravchuk.
Michael yes. Kravchuk, thank you.
Yes. So Michael is a champion. He's a hydrologist in Slovakia, and he is a champion of the small water cycle, and talks about how civilizations built our cities and our roads and everything to get rid of water, and how that means that we're losing water in the small water cycle, because you want to, as you're implying, you want to keep water local. In a healthy system, one water droplet can recycle several times. And so you're not losing that water. You want to hold the water in the landscape, because if it doesn't dry out, then you're less likely to suffer from floods and you're less likely to suffer from drought. And if you're growing things, you need to irrigate less. So the more that we can hold water and have it move more slowly, because when water moves quickly, it carries away the topsoil, it carries away all the pollutants. If a farmer nearby or the municipality has sprayed pesticides and herbicides on the land, well, then that's just going to run off into your property, and you don't want that. So we want to keep water local. So Michael and colleagues, including a botanist named Jan Pokorny, who I'm thinking of because I was actually just corresponding with him, wrote this booklet called Water for the Recovery of the Climate, the New Water Paradigm. And it's really extraordinary and also calls attention to the way that when you have healthy plants, including healthy forests, you get a lot of transpiration. That's the upward movement of water through plants so that it comes out as it turns the wet water, water in its liquid form, into water vapor, which consumes energy because you know that it takes energy to boil a kettle. It consumes energy, and therefore it is a cooling mechanism. It takes solar radiation, solar heat, and so it doesn't become sensible heat or heat you can feel, but rather latent heat that is held in abeyance in the air. And of course, then the opposite, the mirror process is condensation, but ideally that happens further up in the atmosphere. So the heat is radiated out to space.
Right. So I think, you know, we've really botched things up by creating this infrastructure of tar and asphalt and cement and trying to sluice water at high speed away from settled areas where people are living because it's seen as an inconvenience when it's the very thing we need to keep the planet operating at optimal level. As I was saying earlier, you can't go to a town meeting and bring up the subject of water quality or water quantity without someone, either the mayor or a member of the select board, saying, well, is there someone from Public Works here who can address that? It's always seen as an infrastructure problem instead right. of a water retention, water absorption question. Right.
Because that is how we've been trained to think.
Right.
And also it puts people to work, these big infrastructure projects, building dams, building water transferal systems. I mean, if you look at the state of California, the amount of energy that is used to pump water from here to there is just extraordinary. But again, if you do work locally, you have more water to work with than you think, because even in the driest years, they could still meet something like 50% of their water needs in a city like Los Angeles, just due to the rain that falls. Because whenever you've got rain falling, you have a resource. So it's thinking of it as a resource as opposed to a problem.
Exactly. So we survived for a long time with parking lots that were either gravel or dirt, but suddenly we're paving everything now. We're paving parking lots, driveways, obviously streets and highways. And that's now why we have organizations like depave.org that is ripping up pavement wherever they can and planting it with soil and native plants to try to absorb some of this water so we can get back to a balance. But I think we've really gone way beyond a tipping point already.
Well, the other thing is that all that pavement absorbs heat. So then water often evaporates immediately if you have pavement or if you have bare ground. So really, for so many reasons, bare ground is the enemy. You want everywhere to be covered with living roots, living plants.
Right.
That are building the soil and that are areas that can hold onto the water and do all sorts of other wonderful functions.
Right. So now, what does water justice look like to you? How would you define it?
Oh, wow. Well, first of all, clean, drinkable water as a human right. I mean, if we made that a goal and really worked at it collectively, so many other problems would ease, from our health, from lack of water, poor water quality. Poor water quality is a challenge for farmers. And the more irrigation is done, that can lead to salinity. Water justice would be that everybody and every look that people and towns and villages and cities, people were, had more responsibility for their water and therefore more agency and more rights. But again, not always just sending it out to the engineers, like that it's away, that it's over there. I think the more water literacy we all have, and the more involved we are. One example of taking responsibility, I know that there are some places where somebody is taxed at a higher rate per amount of impervious surface they have on their property. And that makes sense because that is costing the public more.
Right. Do you think people are getting it? I mean, since you've written your book, do you think people are becoming more and more aware that it's not about pointing at the sky and saying, oh, climate change is creating these monstrous storms and flooding and drought, and are starting to really get it, that it's what each person does on an individual level with the water on their property?
Right, right. That's hard to say because I'm in my circle, people get it. But then often I'll be listening to the news and there will be discussions about water or about climate. And, you know, I'm yelling back at the radio because they don't get it.
It's certainly not something you see taught in the elementary schools or high schools, small water systems.
Right. There are programs if people are so inclined. One place I'd like to give a real shout out to is Water Stories. You could look up waterstories.com. And that's a platform for water literacy, water climate interactions, and how to really become a water professional or be involved in regenerating the water cycle on your own property. There are courses, there are webinars, and then there's also a community where people can ask each other questions.
Right. What would you suggest to people who are starting to understand how things work and want to make a difference in their own backyard and front yard too? What is it they could do?
Well, first, observe. Look at where the water pools on your property, because many people have very wet areas. And what you can do is you can plant water-loving species there, like willows, for example, or native plants that like more water, because plants have their own preferences. So rather than fighting nature and saying, I want this plant there, regardless of what conditions lead that plant to thrive, you can think about the conditions that you have on your land and where might different types of plants, shrubs, trees, flowers, crops, where might they thrive? That's one thing you can do. You could learn how to create water retention landscapes or hire somebody to do that. And because Zach Weiss, who runs Water Stories, is training as many people as he can in water retention, building water retention landscapes and helping people learn how to ensure that water flows in the way that they want it to on their land, there will be more people who are able to do that. But also you can very simply see how water flows, and you can put rocks or wood in a way that it steers it away from where you don't want it to go, for example. And that sounds like a heavy lift, but if you take a permaculture design course, you can learn some of the basics of how to do that. And that's within the realm of possibility without too much effort. I took a permaculture design course. I really enjoyed it. I learned a lot. I also learned my limits, and I ended up hiring my teacher to help me plan an orchard in the bottom of our meadow. But yeah, work with what you've got.
That is great. So now in the few minutes we have remaining, your book also talks about holistic management. Could you touch on that for just a few minutes? Because I know it ties in.
Yeah, yeah. So holistic management is the framework that was designed building on Indigenous knowledge, as has permaculture, to help people create thriving landscapes. Holistic management is usually applied to grazing systems. So learning from nature how moving animals around the way that they would be in a natural landscape, even though we don't have those natural landscapes anymore because we've built houses and roads and killed off predators, because the predators would normally manage the grazing animals. Yeah, so it's done in a way, and I've done a little bit of training in that too. And what was interesting to me is you begin not with where do I put the animals, the sheep or the cows, but rather almost the inverse, where do I want to keep the animals away? So for instance, if there's an area in a landscape where there are ducks, you know, water birds that nest at a certain time, a certain month, well, then you make sure that you don't have the cattle there that month. So you move them around and you're always observing and always asking questions. I love the fact that they say that when they make their plan, it's always in pencil because you assume that you're going to be wrong because circumstances always change. And that takes off the pressure from having to be right. You know, when we make a decision to do something, often we become invested in that decision and we don't want to be shown where we're wrong. But if you enter into the process, assuming that you're wrong, then things are wide open. And I found it interesting to see that there are people that have trained in both permaculture and holistic management, and the design perspective and the decision-making perspective combined are very powerful.
That is great. You traveled to Zimbabwe.
Yeah. I was just going to say that to me, this is not merely abstract because I've seen landscapes that have been healed dramatically through the use of grazing animals as a technology, moving them around. So the animals are interacting with the landscape in a way that they're reviving that landscape. So another way to think about it is that in nature, disturbance or change and disturbance are always constants. You know, something's always happening. And those processes, the way that animals behave and their digestive processes and their elimination, by that I mean their poop and urine, that creates our landscapes, including the water cycle. A healthy water cycle depends on having animals in the landscape because cattle, their hooves create little areas for water to pool, their behavior, their grazing, and their waste builds carbon in the soil. And that means that the soil then can hold water like a sponge. Beavers, of course, have a huge impact on the water cycle. And that is being in a positive way. And that is being recognized more and more. So, yeah, and worms, everything. Worms, dung beetles, they create areas, pathways in the soil for water and oxygen and air to flow.
And animals' hooves push seeds into the soil?
That's true. They do. So you get a diversity of plants.
Right. Judith, it always gives me so much hope after speaking to you. You know, it makes me realize that it's just a matter of education and awareness for everyone so that we can reclaim our small water systems and start getting under control these outrageous drought and flood cycles. We're not caught, we're not stuck, and we're not trapped. We have a lot of choices and a lot of ways to calm the system down, to kind of bring it back to normal, which you just outlined so incredibly well. So your book, Water in Plain Sight, Hope for a Thirsty World, I think, as I was saying earlier, it's more relevant every day.
Well, thank you. And thank you for spreading the word, because as you say, the more people we can invite into this conversation and invite into seeing our interactions, you know, humans' interactions with ecology, the better.
I'd like to thank Judith Schwartz for joining us today. You can find out more about Judith and her work by going to her website at judithschwartz.com.
Join Americans everywhere in the One Third for the Birds movement. Dedicate the back third of your yard to birds and other wildlife. Make this area a quiet zone with no leaf blowers or lawnmowers. Plant native trees and shrubs so birds have plenty of insects to eat. Create a safe haven for birds to nest and raise their young. You will be rewarded with many hours of bird watching fun. For more information on One Third for the Birds, go to the Bird Hugger page on Facebook.
And that's it for today's episode, everybody. Thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Have a great week and enjoy the birds. Bye for now.